Hi, this is Bill Thomas, and it's time for Prairie Public Presents. It's when we bring you things that aren't part of our daily or weekly schedules, but we thought they were good, and you'd like to hear them. Today, author Mona Susan Power, from her appearance on Humanities ND's webinar series, they call it One Book, One North Dakota. Mona has roots in Standing Rock and Chicago, and in 1994 published a book, The Grass Dancer, which surprised her by winning major national awards. Most recently, she published Sacred Wilderness, which I just read and really enjoyed. If you keep listening, you'll hear some new material that hasn't been published yet. Here is Mona Susan Power, interviewed by Jamie Ridenour.
In the past, my earlier writing, I was much more self-conscious, and there were writers I admired who were a great influence for the good, which benefited me. I learned so much from them. But I was consciously always trying to be lyrical in my language. I wanted almost this fairy tale quality in certain pieces. I feel like I was in my own way being much too, the word I keep coming up with, self-conscious about it all, planning too much. And now what happens is I'm learning to get out of my own way, to surrender more to the process. And also back then, I love language so much. So I was reading a lot of literary work, literary fiction in particular, and I still do, and I still care very much about the crafting of sentences, and I read my work aloud to listen to it, and the rhythms are still important to me. But now I pay more attention to what the story itself is calling for, what the characters are calling for, what they need from me. It doesn't have to be lyrical. Sometimes just simple clarity is all you need, and just get out of the way and let them talk. And also, I'm not so afraid to think of myself as writing literary horror. I didn't feel like I could do that. It just seemed like it would be too much fun. You know, I was raised Catholic. I'm no longer Catholic, but there's still that Catholic guilt in me. Like, could I really do horror? Like, is that okay? And now I'm like, yes. And so I'm writing all these ghost stories and what I call kind of cracked, tilted, something's just a little off, a little wrong stories. And they're so much fun. I have this whole collection that's been quickly developing, and some of them they're not even scary. Something's just off, kind of like Fractured Fairy Tales, for those of you who remember the Bullwinkle program from way back when. So I'm just embracing all of that, the strange, the dark. I'm just, come on in.
Well, it is, because it is scary. I mean, not obviously horror is scary, that's what it does, but it's scary as a writer to have that kind of vulnerability out there.
Oh yes, especially with the memoir I'm working on. So right now it is developing into a memoir. I call it essays. I'm writing personal essays, dipping my toe in that water. Again, I wrote personal essays before, but they were only shining a light on all that is positive. And there's a great deal that is wonderful and positive in my immediate family. And I was raised by people I absolutely adore. I've often said I would never choose different parents ever. But there were problems. But I didn't, you know, you don't want to betray anyone. You don't want to, you know, quote, put your stuff out there. On the other hand, I've been on this healing journey that's finally bearing fruit, which is changing everything for the better, even during this pandemic year, which has been so difficult. And I had a really bad accident weeks ago where I badly broke my upper arm. But I'm still happy. I'm really happier than I've been ever before, despite all of that. So I want to share that with other people. I want to share what worked for me with other people. And to do that, I have to touch on what set me on this path of depression and anxiety and all of those things, and what are the triggers that I still contend with. So I have to start going there, but that has been very scary. And I remember the first time I wrote an essay like that was really personal, that wasn't all just the happy, shiny stuff. And I'd been invited to give a reading at Birchbark Books, the wonderful bookstore in Minneapolis owned by Louise Erdrich. And it was Mother's Day, and we were celebrating Mother's Day and an anthology about our mothers that was put together by women writers, and the editor was Kate Kaiser. And I warned everybody, is it okay if I read something that's not happy Mother's Day kind of fair? So I wrote a piece about some of the challenges that I had with my beloved mother. You know, she's still alive, 96 years old. And I just, but my hands were shaking as I gave that reading. And I'm a big ham. I wasn't did theater, acting classes. I love giving public performances and readings, but that was really scary for me.
When you have living family members or living or people in your life who are going to be cast in, if not a completely negative light, at least a complicated light, do you just take a breath and jump? Do you give them a heads up? Do you let people know?
Well, in the beginning there, I knew that that public reading was not going to be recorded. I kept giving myself permission to just write it. I'm like, you don't have to send any of this out. Okay. So just write it, write what you need to write. And I'm glad that I didn't start sending it out right away because I hadn't yet crossed over to forgiveness. I've now had a massive breakthrough where those who have caused the most pain and harm in my life, I absolutely forgive them completely and deeply. And I mean it, I'm not just saying it, you know, I really got there where I could understand that it's not excusing bad, terrible behavior, sometimes dangerous behavior, but it's understanding that they're wounded, that these things happen to them. And it's that cycle repeating. And for whatever reason, they didn't have the space, the opportunities, the advantages I've had so that they could heal it. So I forgive. That means that now as I write about these things, it's from a place of absolute forgiveness. I know I have no axe to grind. I know that, you know, my conscience is clear. The two people who really had the greatest impact on me, my parents, my father has been gone for many years since I was 11. And my mother, we can still have wonderful conversations, but she has Alzheimer's and dementia and she can't absorb anything she reads anymore. Nothing I can write or record is going to bring her harm. And I have to say, she seemed to be able to feel it when I really forgave. I didn't tell her, but our relationship changed. She just, she was just sweet and patient. And we were just so happy together. It just, you know, she could tell. She could feel it deep down. So now I'm not so afraid to write. To go there with my writing. And I'm always careful to set it up within a larger context so that this isn't about me. I mean, it is there personally very much about me, of course, but big picture, it's not about me. The story's not about me. It's always set within this context of what happened to these other generations. And so it's set within generational trauma. There are no good guys and bad guys. They are simply wounded people.
You've got two things that you've talked about you're doing now. You're working on a memoir and engaging with letting go and this forgiveness. And you're also writing a group of ghost stories. So how are those things related, or are they?
Yes. I mean, it's the healthier I become, the more everything is integrated. The more everything is just coming from authentic me who can talk about all of it, throw it all out there. When I'm teaching a writing workshop, I'm drawing from my personal history and as well as published writing, as well as references to popular movies or television shows. You know, it's all, so anything that just merits my attention has meant something to me. It's all mixed in there together. I have now 4 novels that I'm working on, not actively working on all of them. There's one that I really am close to finishing, but then this flurry of ghost stories interrupted. And I had to sort of sit down with myself and say, okay, is this self-sabotage? You're close to finishing that novel. Is this you being afraid to finish that novel? And I can really be ruggedly honest with myself. And this inner voice was like, no, you really need to feel the satisfaction of finishing some pieces right now and getting them out into the world right now. So just go for it. You'll get back to the novel very soon. And I was like, okay. And I have to say, it has been just a pleasure to finish piece after piece after piece and just throw them out there into the world, you know, send them out for publication. And then take notes on all these other novels that are waiting for me to return to them. And I just have suddenly hit this point where I just have so much incoming in terms of voices, inspiration, ideas. You know, I'm constantly keeping notes to and putting it all in these little folders so I won't lose it. Because we'll have these great ideas and we'll think, oh, we'll surely remember that. Yeah, no, take notes.
But we've got Grass Dancer, we've got Ruth Walker, we have Sacred Wilderness. What kind of relationship do you feel like you have with that earlier work?
I'm really grateful for all of those earlier works. So I haven't turned on them. I did the best possible job with each of them that I could, given what I knew at the time, given my abilities. And so I have a real fondness for the characters who showed up. Certainly Sacred Wilderness, that's not as long ago. So I have a deep abiding love for those characters, especially the four clan mother characters who showed up. That one was just very special in terms of the process. It really felt more like a spiritual journey for me than an artistic one, even though I definitely worked to craft the art of it. The Grass Dancer, I'm very fond of when I pick it up, but it does feel like it was from another lifetime, another era completely in my process, not one I reject. It was a stepping stone. And I'm so grateful that it did as well as it did, because as I said, that's helped keep me afloat for many years. Yeah, I have to say—
Oh,
I was just gonna say—
Sorry, go ahead.
I feel, even, and going back to Grass Dancer and even before Grass Dancer, I feel I don't ever choose my stories, the characters. I'm being tapped by someone who has a story they want to tell. I have to be in service to them.
But I do understand that moment when you know your characters well enough that it's almost as if they're writing the dialogue themselves. Like, you know, you're in a scene and you're like, oh, I know what that person's going to say next, not because I planned it, but because I know who they are and how they're going to, and that's when you kind of know you've got it, right? Like you're—
Yeah, and sometimes they don't show up completely all at once. Sometimes there are major mysteries that I have to figure out about them that they don't just offer up right away. Right. So I don't feel like their creator, you know, I feel like they've come to haunt me basically. Right. And I have to find out what they want. What's their story? Right. What's their issue? What's the problem? What can I do to help? A lot of times I've discovered that when they don't just share with me what their deepest, darkest secret is, the thing that really needs to be figured out for me to go forward with them. It's because I've been judging them in some way. And in Sacred Wilderness, it was my Ruby character who was the first one in her family to walk away from her people, Ganyengeaga Mohawk people. And so generations that came after her weren't connected to their nation because she was the one who walked away. I kind of was judging her, thinking, oh, she might've been of this generation where some of them, because it was so difficult being Native, were maybe ashamed. And so she took a few years before she opened up to me because, you know, part of her, I feel like, was thinking, you know, who are you? You don't know anything about me and you're already judging me and rah, 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 you know? So finally, after a few years where I didn't give up and I didn't give up, it's like she trusted me at long last and just told me her story in this one chapter. And oh my God, it blew me away. And I had so misread her. So I always find that the truth of these fictional characters is so much more complicated and interesting than what I would just make up for them if I were the puppet master of them.
We've got a couple of questions already down here, and it's going to pull us back into Grass Dancer. Brenna Gerhardt has asked, why did you kill off Pumpkin so soon?
She annoyed me. I mean, I knew that when I say I knew, this is intuitive knowing. Some part of me knew Pumpkin was just not going to survive the novel, that she had to go connected to Harley, and that her death was going to trigger Harley, and Harley trumped her as a character. He was just a more major character in the book. But also she annoyed me, so I didn't mind killing her off. And as I mentioned, it took me a while to figure out why did she annoy me so much. Mm-hmm. She was me, but I had people telling me off about that. I was at a literary festival in Norway when this tall, he seemed to me like 7 feet tall, a gentleman was standing, and an elder, and he had his hands on his fists, and he said, Susan Bauer, I am very angry with you. And I'd never met this man in my life. And I don't go around smacking people or, you know, being rude. And I thought about it and I said, 'cause I killed off Pumpkin. And he said, yeah. So I know. I'm sorry, everyone. I wouldn't kill off the me character now because I love myself now. So sure. I've made progress.
It makes total sense on a psychological level, but it's pretty, I mean, it's a lovely thing as a writer that people would love a character that much, that you've literally got strangers halfway around the world who are pissed off at you because of what you've done to a character in your book. I mean, that's...
Oh, absolutely. It was great that people would have invested that much.
Right, but, right. Yeah. They care about it, that you made her real, right? They felt like they had lost a friend.
And it also was kind of personally nice. It was like, oh, she's the closest to being me and they like her, you know? maybe I am likable.
Self-affirmation.
Yeah. As a quick aside, since you mentioned Bismarck, I just finished a week ago or so writing a short story that is set in Bismarck at United Tribes. I have an aunt, she's passed away now, but an aunt, Bertha Gipp, who is a nurse, and she lived at United Tribes. She was a nurse for the school there, and a very haunted place. And so I wrote Dead Owls and had so much fun remembering that period when I would come to Bismarck fairly often, and what it was like back then, like when everyone called when the Kirkwood Mall was still new and everyone was like, ooh, the new mall, the new, and for 10 years, we were still calling it the new mall, you know, or the new, so.
I've got a couple of writing specific, like craft questions from Galen Grody. One of it's just a straightforward, do you offer online workshops?
Not personally. I'm teaching one right now through the North Dakota Humanities Council. I have had people reach out to me as far as doing personal writing coaching. And so, you know, sometimes I will do that. I've just started doing a little bit of that. People can find me on Facebook and message me there if they want to know more about that. Yeah. Just send it to Mona Susan Power on Facebook.
Sure. And she also asks, do you outline your stories or books? So that's the perennial question, right? Are you a plotter or a pantser? Do you know those terms?
Yeah. And I don't outline stories, although I certainly sit back and think about, I'm not just writing and writing and writing and completely writing my way into it. I will pause and think about, well, how is this going to happen? Well, where is this going? Where do you think this is going to end up? And I will often write out of order. I might have the ending all figured out. So I'll write that first and then I'll write my way to that ending. But novels, at some point I do have to outline just for me, especially because I've written more of them than have been published. So I've only have two published, but I've written many more. So my process with writing a novel seems to be that I cannot just, I'm always moving around through time quite a bit and have many generations involved. So it can get really messy and I have to sort out so many different characters' stories and how am I going to weave them together and that sort of thing. So it gets complicated and I have to start outlining. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, do you know like point by point? Because you're right, you do have a lot of different generations going on, a lot of stories.
I absolutely don't. It will, when I outline, it's not in great detail, but I have to figure out what the structure is going to be. So I start to figure out, I always have so many different character voices involved I leave myself a lot of room for discovery and it's not, you know, an outline for me for a novel would maybe be one page long. So that gives you some idea. Sure. It's not that detailed. Yeah. And I'm happy to, I timed various things today. If people wanted a taste of what I'm doing now.
I would love that. Yeah. I'm sorry. I forgot you wanted to do that. Yeah. While we wait for some questions to come in, could you read us an excerpt of something?
And before she gets going on those readings, which I thought were quite good, by the way, I've heard them already. Let me remind you that you're listening to Prairie Public Presents. This is Mona Susan Power, author of The Grass Dancer, The Sacred Wilderness, and new works to come. She is being interviewed by Jamie Ridenour as part of Humanities ND's One Book, One North Dakota. And you can check out the series and look at past episodes and see what's coming up at humanitiesnd.org.
Sure. I thought maybe I would read an excerpt from the nonfiction, how I'm writing about family, and then maybe an excerpt from fiction, if that sounds like that would be workable.
Excellent. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. And I organized this the best that I could. It'll just take me a second. Let me see. Okay. I've got two different choices. They're both. Okay, let me just do this one. This is, okay, no, let me do this one. Sorry, I'm having another moment here. Okay, all right.
Live and unrehearsed, folks.
This is from an unpublished essay titled Blood Thread, although the title keeps changing, so don't count on the title. Okay. So there's a lot in it about me, but I'm not going there. So Mama is a born storyteller. She uses her hands and face and eyes to dramatize each moment. Her tales are so vivid, she takes me back in time with her, erasing all boundaries between us. In this way, I live Mama's childhood with her and her parents' childhood. Some days, their experiences are more real to me than my own. It's 1934 and Prohibition has ended in the United States, but not on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Mama is 9 years old and her sister Elsie is 10. They look like twin boys, barefoot, dressed in overalls, their thick black hair cut short. They have two older siblings and four younger ones that haven't all been born yet. Elsie is everyone's favorite. She has the best ideas for getting into mischief and has created a small cemetery she's made in the yard where she respectfully buries birds, dead birds and frogs, and pretend buries people she doesn't like who are still alive and breathing. Mama and Elsie are playing in the yard while their mother is inside their two-room cabin trying to find something to put on the table. Everyone who doesn't work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs is hungry. Mama and Elsie are bent over the ground, gouging it with sticks. Their imaginations swoop together in the wind, closing them up in whatever stories they're telling. A distant voice hollers, "Hey! Hey!" But they're too busy dreaming to hear. The voice gets closer, louder, until their father stands over them and blocks the sun. He pulls them from their game, turns day into night. Mama and Elsie leap to their feet, fully awake and alert now, scenting the wind like cautious deer. Their father is Dakota, though Irish enough to sometimes pass for white when he tries buying booze in a state that won't sell to Indians. It's illegal for them to drink. So sometimes all he can get his hands on is homemade stuff, lethal as rubbing alcohol, hooch that makes him blind drunk, makes him hallucinate his children into other people. Colvin Kelly, people call him Collie, is handsome as a film star. Women like him a lot, even though he stumps around on a wooden leg. He speaks all three dialects of his people's language, Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota, and his vocabulary is immense, as if he's time crawled from the days before white people and hauled back the words beaten out of his generation. His speech is like listening to older, happier times, except for those days when he's monster drunk. Today, Colvin is mad with the drink, brain haunted by too many bad memories, how he kept being dragged off from North Dakota to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, though he didn't want to be there for even a minute, parading in a stiff wool uniform and tight shoes, hammered by English, kept awake at night by the crying of boys from 100 tribes, all of them shorn and shamed and beaten. He was homesick, determined to grow up Dakota, so he ran away from Carlisle several times, eventually suffering an accident in Youngstown, Ohio, as he jumped onto open boxcars riding the rails west. He slipped beneath a train and lost part of his foot. Infection set in and ultimately claimed the whole leg. He remembers the agents and policemen, how they removed him from his family, his tribal nation, his Dakota territory. He remembers the ghost of a little sister he loved so well, Elsie, who died of trouble with the lungs. He names his second daughter after her. He recalls how she used to hold his hand and look up to him as if he were the best thing in the whole world, an unbroken boy capable of magic. He remembers the feel of her small hand in his rough one, and how, when he reached in the closet after her death, He felt the surprised squeeze of her hand, like she'd been haunting the closet, waiting for him to find her. No one will take him away from his sister again. Take him away from his reservation. Take him away from Dakota words that put him back together every time he comes apart. No goddamn agent is going to haul him anywhere ever again. Colvin Kelly holds a shotgun on his daughters. His girls aren't girls any longer, but government agents who want to take him somewhere he refuses to go. He tells them he'll kill them if they move even a finger. Elsie and my mother stop breathing. They are frozen girls, too afraid to look anywhere but straight ahead at their father. They don't speak. Their father does all the talking. He shouts at them in English, that language of enemies. Their father is so fixated on them, he doesn't notice when his wife sends the oldest girl to run for help. How long does it take her to summon Colvin's friends? My mother will never know for sure. She stands like a carved statue for what seems like forever. She can hear her heart pounding wildly as if it will charge right out of her chest. Fear is greasy in her mouth. She keeps swallowing it as quietly as possible. She doesn't want her father to murder her in their yard. So that's an excerpt from that piece. And I just wanted to read the very ending of it, which is much shorter, very short, okay. If that's okay.
Yeah, no, everything's okay.
There are two little bits. Okay. I am astonished at how much anger can live in our cells, how many hard stories we inherit and carry and sometimes bleed out in dark splashes. Someone looks at us funny and the next minute we're picking anger out of our teeth, chewing on old hurts that might not be our own. Mama says the only way she survived her life is to write down all her sorrows and fears and gripes, then destroy the pages before anyone else can read them. I'm touched by this gesture, this desire to avoid causing harm. I don't tell her I've been reading her secret pages my whole life because she's written them in shorthand all over me. I tell Mama my writing has changed. I've stopped covering only the bright side of the moon. Sometimes the moon is so ripe and close in the sky, I feel I can pluck her off a tree of stars. I imagine the full body of her, what I can see and all that is hidden. I begin unearthing stories from my joints and my bones. I am my own archaeologist, excavating scar tissue that has grown around ancient wounds. I dream of my grandfather, whom I never met. He's a boy young enough to be my grandson. Takoja, I call him, and he smiles at me, a full, beautiful smile that doesn't hide anything. That's all there is to the dream, his smile. I remember Mama's story about the ghost in the closet, how he felt his little sister's hand grasp his after she was dead. I wonder if maybe it was my hand too, reaching across years through the mystery of time to press encouragement on a tired boy, flesh to flesh, each of us so different, yet each of us the same. Mama says that when I write, I might think I'm alone, but really, there's a throng in the room, people looking over my shoulder and tapping my arm, whispers, tears, the belly laugh of survival humor. She tells me to listen, even though she's afraid of what they will say. I assure her that I'm listening, my spirit and heart wide open. I invite my ancestors to bring forward what is already inside me. I ask their forgiveness if I say too much. I explain that I've spent a lifetime saying too little. Their photographs surround me in this workroom, and though few of them are smiling, there's comfort in seeing their strong, surviving faces. They haunt me in a good way as I search for the next word and the next. They tell me that this generation is the one to heal a lot of bad stories. They tell me to keep talking and writing and facing that dark side of the moon. They tell me it's the only way to not be a ghost while I'm still alive. I don't want to haunt myself. So thank you for giving me this platform to share some of that. And I'm happy to say, yeah, I feel less haunted every single day. the more I'm able to go to these places, and the more I'm able to just have so much compassion for all of these earlier generations who weren't as lucky as me. They were just in the crisis of survival every moment of every day, practically. They didn't have that leisure time, that space to do all the contemplation and figuring out that I have. So, yeah.
That scene with your grandfather was so powerful. What is it like to bring, because there is, because this is, you call this nonfiction, and it is nonfiction, but you then tell us that you never met your grandfather, who you were in his head in that scene. So what is it like to bring kind of the fiction writer's eye for character and detail to people that are actually your ancestors? Because there is a piece of imagining involved in retelling that scene, yes?
Absolutely. And that's why I preface it by saying that, and giving credit to my mother, the storyteller. And she, my mother, I have to say, I mean, now her memory is compromised, and people who want historical information from her, it's not trustworthy anymore. It'll be very mixed with what's true and what's not. But that only is recent. My mother had this phenomenal memory for history, just really an incredibly genius memory for specific details. And she also was such a storyteller. So she would make it feel, in recounting these stories, as if I was there. And so I put that in there to preface when I am taking this leap, that what is past doesn't feel like past to me, even, you know, when it happened before I was born. It feels like I was living it because my mother helped me to do that. And then also, as you mentioned, having the technical skills of craft of fiction writing to bring it to life, that really helps. But it's all so real to me. Just my mother would tell me these stories over and over and practically acting them out. And so, you know, I feel as if I know so many of my ancestors because of that.
Sure. We've got some questions in the sure. chat. Let's do two or three questions and then maybe close with you reading a piece of fiction, if you don't mind.
That sounds fantastic.
We have people saying that it's beautiful, and it was beautiful, and someone saying read more. So we'll definitely. Oh.
Well, thank you. Bless you for your kind comments. I've got some friends out there I know, so my friends are probably, you know, being encouraging.
So Maggie Coles asks wondering how Grass Dancer was received on Standing Rock. What was the reaction there?
Yeah, I was a little bit like, chewing on my fingers, because I didn't grow up there. I did visit family there, so it's not as if it was unfamiliar to me. It was familiar territory physically, and also in terms of connections and the family and knowing how these networks work. And culturally, I was raised Native, even though I was born and raised in Chicago. My dad wasn't interested in his background. And so I was always Native first and foremost. And my mother is so proudly Dakota, you know, that's a part, that's just who I am. But you can never please everyone as a writer. And now we have many more Native writers being published. But back then in 1994, it's not like we had a whole flood of them. And so everything that was put out there carried so much weight. And being one of the few Dakota writers out there at that time, you know, that just, there was all this responsibility attached. And I was lucky as I traveled throughout Dakota territory that I'm sure there were people out there who were not happy with one thing or the other, but I didn't hear from them. Now, we also didn't have social media back then. Lord knows what tweets I would have gotten, you know, incoming. But I only heard, you know, just people saying, this is like my auntie, that's familiar to me. And so, you know, I was just so grateful for that. And I got to travel throughout North Dakota thanks to the Humanities Council. They brought me and Mom out together to do this tour of the state, going to reservations and also to different universities in the state to give. She would talk about our family history and show her gifts as a storyteller, a history storyteller. She wasn't making things up. And then I would give my readings from the book and talk about craft as a writer. So we were like this, our little dog and pony show going all throughout the state. It was a lot of fun. She had a riot too. She really enjoyed that.
Well, I would think too, given, because you're right, there was a dearth of Native writers in the early 90s. And there was probably a gratefulness for the representation, for for having an authentic voice telling these stories.
I mean, there are little things that I would change. One thing, when I set something in a different time period, I'm always trying to be careful to be authentic for that time period, use the language, the terminology. And then, times change and language hits us differently. And one thing that now I cringe about, because people don't always know where it's coming from. I think it was maybe in the 80s when we had more Native people who started to go to college, and they started to be sensitive to the language that we use about ourselves and about our traditions, that language really matters. But I grew up in the 1960s. I was born in 1961. And back then, when we would talk about our traditional clothes, the clothes that we would wear at powwows, we didn't use the term regalia. If you use the term regalia, somebody would laugh. You're like, who? Like, people would be like, what's that? What does that mean? You know? And so people would say, put on your outfit or put on your costume. Did you bring your costume? We weren't politically correct. So because, the grass dancer has sections set in the 60s and the, at a time period where people I knew would sometimes use that language, I use that. But nowadays, I would actually just, I would have like a little asterisk or a footnote or something. There are a few places in there where I'm being true to the time, but now it has a different, it falls on you differently.
A completely different type of question, but I'm glad this got asked. A question coming, it was asked on Facebook apparently. What are you currently reading? And do you have any recommended reading?
Yes, actually right now I have, what I'm reading is all unpublished. right now I'm actually reading the best of something that's published, The Best American Short Stories for 2020. And see, right now I can't rattle off a lot of fiction because I'm doing all this research. So it's a lot of, whenever I'm asked that, I go blank. I'm always like, I just finished a novel not so long ago, but I can't remember the names and all that. But I can recommend. And if any of you have never heard of Leanne Howe, H-O-W-E, please check out her writing. She is a Choctaw author and just one of my favorite writers in the world. Of course, Louise Erdrich is one of my all-time favorites, but boy, Leanne Howe is one of my favorites as well. And she has novels. She has a travel book. She has this fantastic, what I call a play in poems. That's her latest book. It's called Savage Conversations. And it's inspired by actually the mental health issues of Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, and how she was being haunted by what she called a savage Indian. And he showed up in Leanne's imagination as one of the Dakota men who had been hanged by order of her husband, Abraham Lincoln, when he was president in Mankato, just one of the horrific, horrific moments in Dakota history. And so Savage Conversations are these conversations between Mary Todd Lincoln and this native man, Dakota man, and then Rope at some point showed up as a character, being one of the actual ropes that was used as a noose back then. It's just stunning, powerful, blow you away. And she also is a poet. And Hyde Erdrich, all of her poetry. Little Big Bully is her most recent collection. Just brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. I should remember to make out a list because there are just so many terrific new books out by Native authors that are just, I'm so excited about. And but I'm just drawing a blank. I'm sorry.
That was a good recommendation. And Maureen in the chat is affirming that, saying that Leanne's work is amazing. And
Shellshaker, for those who love novels, start with Shellshaker.
Shellshaker, okay, Shellshaker.
You see, wait a little bit and things will come to you. not all the time, but some of the time. You're listening to Prairie Public Presents. Susan Mona Power, honored author with roots in Chicago and Standing Rock, author of The Grass Dancer, her best-known book, Sacred Wilderness, came out more recently, and she's doing readings from upcoming work that have not been published yet, so this is kind of a treat. This is part of Humanities ND's One Book, One North Dakota series. You can find out more about it by going to humanitiesnd.org. Let's sit back for some more performance.
So while we wait, would you mind reading another piece for us? Could you do a piece of fiction?
I would be absolutely happy to. And I think this one takes about 8 minutes, so that would take us to about a quarter after.
Yeah, that'll be good. And then we can decide then if we're what we're going to do at that point.
Okay, sounds good. So this is from the novel that shouldn't take me that much longer to write if I'm to finish writing, if I'm allowed to finally do that. And I don't know what its title is going to be. The working title is long. Harvard Indian Seance at the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast. And it's set in Massachusetts, where I lived for 14 years, where my white ancestors are from on my dad's side of the family. So Massachusetts is also near and dear to my heart. And I went to Harvard undergrad. So, and I've gone back for visits. So the idea about this novel is there are five Native students, all of them seniors at Harvard. And they're all from different tribal nations, and because it wouldn't be realistic to have them all one tribe. We just don't have that many Native students there. So you always get quite a lot of diversity. And they're friends, and for their last hurrah together before they all graduate, the only wealthy one of the five of them, who they teasingly, lovingly call the Hollywood Indian because her parents met on the set of Dances with Wolves, and she was born and raised out in Hollywood. And her parents didn't make money that way, though. Whole long story how they made their money. So she decides to rent out for a night the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast in Fall River, Massachusetts, where the two notorious, supposedly still unsolved murders happened in 1892 of an elderly couple. And so by way of research, I have to say a few years back, I used grant money to spend the night there, rented it out, and had Leanne Howe and Andrea Carlson, who's the artist of this painting. We all stayed there together and lived to tell the tale. So these five students, each of them has something from their past, a trauma that hasn't yet been healed. And they bring that into this house. And of course the house has those traumatic murders that happen there. And so it's like they stir that place up without meaning to. And we don't know if they're gonna survive. That said, it is a horror. It's meant to be a horror novel. There are scary things that happen. But another part that's important to me is the academic lives of these five students, because we don't always see a lot of that in books with Native characters. Getting a glimpse into the life of Native scholars, and we have quite a lot of them, you know? So I will shut up and read from an excerpt from the prologue. And this is the Dakota character who's from North Dakota. His name is Kurt Cobain Keepsiegel. His mother was a big fan of Kurt Cobain. Kurt was only 4 years old the night his mother came for him, a precocious four, but still. He was dreaming one of his flying dreams, not the scary one where people chased him into the sky and he had to flap his arms hard to lift off the ground away from the grasp of their hands, but the pleasant one where he perched in a night tree listening to night sounds. And when he was bored, he could rise into the air and float inside a spring breeze. Good smells. The breeze carried good smells. The air cradled his sleep. He felt surrounded by feathers. Then an insinuating noise jostled him out of his peace. The sound that interrupted him was sly, a single fingernail scratching its way down his bedroom window. He awakened and looked to the window. A lady's face peered in at him through the smudged glass, so beautiful he thought she must be the white buffalo calf woman. He knew from his great-grandfather she was very sacred. She taught the people how to behave. And already at four, he sensed this was a larger kind of behave than what was expected of him at this age. The beautiful lady waggled her fingers, a signal that he should leave his small bedroom that slumped off the side of a dilapidated house he shared with his greats. His bed was a low cot, so it was easy for him to slide to the floor and slip on his sneakers, grab Jailbird. Jailbird is his one of those little troll dolls that he loves, by its thick tuft of hair. She waved him to the window as if he should fly straight through it. He shook his head, confused. He wanted to do her bidding, but didn't know how. She solved the problem by walking through the wall, past the peeling shingles and chipped paint, without mussing a strand of her shiny long hair. She held a finger to her lips so he would be quiet, and he was. She led him into the kitchen and through the back door into the yard. She offered her hand for him to take, and it was his first resistance. He remembered what happened to the young hunter who reached out to touch the white buffalo calf woman, how he sizzled to nothing more than a pile of ash. The boy shook his head and clasped his hands behind his back, but he followed the lady when she set off for the road. At first, he thought she was wearing buckskin and moccasins. He saw a dress with long flowing strands of buckskin fringe that emphasized her grace as she rippled down the midnight road. Everything black at first, with her the only candle. Her face was alight as if she'd been born on the moon and was its shining daughter. But as they walked, her appearance changed. Now she was wearing worn down jeans, scuffed boots, and a windbreaker jacket, her hands stuffed in the pockets. When she turned to look at him, her skin was no longer fine and smooth, but pitted with old acne scars, and the glow from her was a more sickly gray. He worried about her, wondered if she had a fever like the one he'd had a while back. She looked sicker the more they walked, the farther away they got from his house. Where were they going? His greats liked to brag on him that he was a real Dakota, the way some internal heart sense could always point him in the direction of home. It was far behind him now, and he realized they were headed for the Hill of Stars, not a real name anyone else used for a broken scrape of land that rose a few feet above the road in a rounded hump. This was where his mother died a month after he was born, her body thrown by a terrified horse. This was where he sometimes saw her when he passed in a car. She looked sad and rained on, her long black hair pasted in strings to her neck. She peered at him, and when they locked eyes, her upper lip would disappear in what he supposed was a smile, the flash of teeth and gray gums, but there was nothing warm in her eyes, only hunger. He made himself smile at her in these encounters to be a good boy. Wasn't he supposed to encourage his mother even if she was dead? But the impulse to get free of the car and run to her never swept over him. In truth, he was too afraid of that toothy smile, the gleam of a wolf. Finally, when the two night travelers reached the foot of the minor hill, he realized the woman he'd been following was his mother. She turned to him and offered that terrible smile. She had tricked him by donning a beautiful mask, but now the mask had slipped. And what was left was a gray cloud of a woman, gaunt and bedraggled. To hide his fear, he tugged at his shirt, plucked it forward to show her the faded picture on its front. "For you," he said. He still didn't have enough words to describe his loyalty, how he wore this t-shirt to bed every night, because it had been hers, picturing her favorite musician, Kurt Cobain, whose name he now carried. She didn't look at the shirt, but her awful smile grew larger. One thin hand scrabbled at her jacket. She unzipped it and lifted her shirt. She wasn't wearing a bra. She reached her other arm to him, and he knew what she wanted, though he'd never been breastfed. He'd seen how the operation worked at powwows or other reservation functions. She wanted to feed him her mother's milk. He was taught to mind his manners and obey his elders. He wanted to please this troubled ghost, but he'd also been taught to listen to his heart, his spirit. He wasn't entirely sure what a spirit was. It sounded elusive as the prairie dog societies. He tried to catch an action above the ground, but he understood hunches and feelings. He could snag a wisp of a felt idea and hammer it down. He did this now. The felt idea said, "No, go home. Don't let her touch you." He backed away, gently patting his t-shirt smooth as if it were her hair or her face. He was stroking. It was all he could offer. Her face pulled into a grimace, and she angrily shook her head. She didn't speak as the living did with words set loose in the air, but her voice was more powerful, filling his head so his own thoughts were crowded to the edges. "Come to me, come to me, come to me," she commanded. Both hands reached for him. Her entire body screamed, "Want." But he knew if she clutched him and fed him her ruined milk, she wouldn't be giving but taking. She would drink him in, some essence of him he wasn't ready to give up yet. He turned and ran as best he could on four-year-old legs, his heart lined up toward home. His run wasn't graceful. He lurched and tripped on loose gravel, but he kept getting up, moving forward. He gripped his doll around its middle hard, as if the troll could save him. His mother howled in his head, and he heard a wind at his back, the rush of her swooping behind him, intent on getting what she came for. He must have closed himself tight as a turtle in its shell because she couldn't prevent him from running home. The worst moment came when he saw the old house silhouetted against a morning sky, the angry red of a blood blister. She couldn't seem to physically touch him, barricaded as he was. But her spirit swept through him so suddenly, the impact knocked him to the ground. It felt like a frozen car had run him down and emptied its contents into his small shape. He was so cold, so freezing. Cold, his body shook and his teeth chattered almost hard enough to break. He stuffed a hand in his mouth and bit down. The taste of his own blood was the warm shock he needed to calm down. The mother he'd never known passed right through him. He could smell the stale wine and vomit of her breath, inhale her rotting desperation. He knew that when people died, they were buried in the earth, and that's what she felt like, his mother, a deep, dark channel torn open in the ground that you couldn't climb out of, you couldn't escape. There were no happy stories in her head, no warm memories in her heart. He cried for her, for the howling madness of her pain. And as his tears fell, warming his face, she leaked out of him. Thank you. With all my intro, it took longer to read.
Oh, that's all right. Wow. I cannot wait for that to get published.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
There is an opening, and I need to, I'll message you. We need to talk horror. I want to talk.
Sounds good.
Well, the thing that it made me think of, and there's been a real opening out of horror as a genre recently. I think it's the right time publishing wise for you to try and do this. Do you know Stephen Graham Jones's work?
Yes, another person I strongly recommend. Oh my goodness, right.
Probably the best known native horror writer. But yeah. Do you know Jeff Barnaby's film work?
The name is familiar, but no.
He's a Micmac filmmaker. The most recent is called Blood Quantum.
Yes. I saw that. Yes. I have a terrible memory for names.
No, that's fine. But I just feel like you're timing it perfectly, and I would love to see. I can't wait to see that book out there. It sounds amazing.
Thank you.
We've got a little less than 10 minutes, and we don't need to necessarily fill that time if people feel like we're done. But if you guys have some final questions for Mona that you want to ask, either about Grass Dancer or about any of the things that we talked about or any of the things that we haven't talked about, give this to them in the chat, and we'll try our best to answer them. And if not, we might just move on.
And actually, you know, there was something that I did wanted to share. And if I were a better speaker, I would speak it. But it's actually something from an interview of mine. And it says quite a bit about why I became a writer. It's really short. It's like a paragraph. So if I could just share that, maybe.
Sure. Go for it.
Because it's something I meant to bring up when we were talking about writing and I couldn't always express myself when I was speaking, but with a pen in my hand, I could make my points. So I was always reaching for that pen. Teachers noted that I had talent when I was in elementary school, but few of them approved of my subject matter in those early years. I wrote about the political themes of my life, racism, poverty, injustice, the war of values between my people and the dominant society. Most teachers wanted me to write about fluffier things, and my political stance was deemed radical. I learned to keep my creative work from the eyes of teachers until I was about to graduate from high school and trusted one terrific English teacher, Darlene McCampbell, and my amazing acting teacher, Lucia Ambrosini. I protected my voice and vision from the influence of those I felt would edit me culturally and politically. Even in college, I didn't take a single creative writing course. Everything I knew about writing, I absorbed from being a voracious reader. I didn't study writing until I attended the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop when I was nearing 30 years old. But by then, I had a strong filter in place. I could take in criticism and appreciate what would strengthen my technique while ignoring what I felt were unhelpful reactions to my different cultural worldview. The reason I wanted to share that, and thank you so much for letting me do so, is because I feel there are a lot of writers out there who struggle with that. That there are people who can discourage them from a young age. Sometimes it's simply a teacher doesn't see talent in a young child and then doesn't, you know, I'm always horrified by people who are like, we need to be realistic and tell people you just don't have talent. And I'm like, talent ain't all it. There are, you know, sometimes people who didn't show talent early on, but they kept writing, they will blow you away with their development. And certainly if you are writing from what is termed the margins of a mainstream society, oh, you face a lot of voices that are telling you, no, don't do that, or your world is crazy. I got so much of that. You know, are all your characters crazy? Just because they were coming from a different place culturally and had different spiritual beliefs. Mm-hmm. I still get that label of magical realism all the time. That drives me crazy. I do not do magical realism. This is my reality. Yeah. Just because it's not your reality, I don't expect it to be your reality. That doesn't mean it's not reality. So
that's Susan Mona Power. And she was interviewed by Jameson Ridenour, who's a playwright, has currently an audio podcast going called Palimpsest. Mona Power, obviously, is an author and most famously of The Grass Dancer, but also Sacred Wilderness and Roof Walkers, a collection of short stories. She's won honors for her fiction and has had pieces published in a whole range of prestigious places. And as you heard, she's working on a lot right now, so we're expecting to see more from Mona Power. Mona Power was part of the One Book, One North Dakota series put together by Humanities ND, the North Dakota Humanities Council. And if you would like to find out more about that series, you can go to their website. It's humanitiesnd.org, where you can read more detail about Mona Power and other authors in the series, and listen to some of the things that have been presented, as well as an abundance of other free programming that they are producing as webinars in these times when the in-person events are not happening so well. So you can go there and find out a lot of things. What do they have, this little push that it's like exercise for your mind, like a gym visit for your mind. So that's humanitiesnd.org. Of course, we are Prairie Public, and you can hear this program and others in the One Book, One North Dakota series that we put on the air, as well as abundant other programming at prairiepublic.org. Stay tuned tonight. We've got great music coming up and On Being later this evening. Just a lot of good things. So stick around.